Okay, thank you very much. Thank you especially for my students, the third year students. I have a couple of first year students who are here, and also from Steve. So Steve Fuller is my supervisor at the University of Oregon. He wrote a lot of books, actually, up to, I think, 25 books. Well, the most famous one is Humanity 2.0 by Palgrave, 2011. And here, he also teaches media sociology at the University of Warwick. And his forthcoming book is about this stuff. It's about technology and media and Walter Lippmann, I assume. So I thought that it is interesting to have him here talking about media objectivity and its difference from scientific objectivity. So, because we are out of time, I think we can start.
Okay. Thank you, okay, well, first of all, thank you for showing up. Thank you, Morteza, for inviting me, and for Tom as well. I think the first thing to say to kind of reinforce this point, the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about in the next few minutes is the stuff that I'm actually teaching to first-year students at Warwick, because there's a sense in which this issue of media objectivity is a really significant issue with regard to how we think about, the public character of information, what it's for, who's producing it. And so this idea of whether the media is objective is quite a significant one. And the reason why scientific objectivity is in the title is because science is normally seen as the kind of institution that normally is providing the kind of gold standard for what objectivity is with regard to knowledge. Okay, so when people criticize the media for not being objective, very often it's because it doesn't seem to admit of scientific standards. Okay, and I'm going to say a little bit about that later on. But first I want to say something about how the idea of media objectivity came into play in the first place. Because the way I approach this topic is in terms of the history of journalism. Okay, so for me, maybe this is a little bit different from how people talk about media. I actually, for me, you know, the core activity of media is journalism. That is to say, the production and distribution of news, and then all the things that surround that. And so one of the things that's very interesting when you look at the term journalism, journalism actually is a term that gets coined in the French Revolution, journalisme, right? And it's basically the pamphlets that are being distributed to get the French people to rise up, to find out what's going on in their society, and to rise up against the king and the monarchy and so forth. And the reason why it was called journalism is because this was kind of news that was being produced on a day-to-day basis, right? Journal is to do with the day. So every day it would come out, and it wouldn't just have the status of some kind of notice board announcement. Because if you think about how people found out about what was going on in their world prior to the rise of journalism, it was typically when the king or parliament, you know, or maybe some firms or whatever would actually indicate, you know, these are the laws, or these are the new things that have come in by ship and you can buy them at certain prices. So it had this kind of relative permanence, as it were, right? But what it didn't have was a kind of recording of the day-to-day activities that would matter to people's lives at a fairly immediate level. And that was the context in which journalism came into being in the first place. Journalism existed before the late 18th century. That is to say, it did exist before the French Revolution. But in fact, it existed in the 17th century. But it was really in the 18th century that it becomes kind of the field that we think about it today, where you actually, and one thing about that field is, of course, and it's certainly true in the French Revolution, it had a disruptive character. Right, so in other words, the whole point of producing all of this information on a daily basis was to provide a kind of counterstream to what was being produced by the government, right? And so from the beginning, right, journalism had this kind of critical stance built into it, okay? This is a stance that actually becomes very, very much part of the general history. So from that standpoint, you know, when we think about journalists as people who are against the establishment, who are questioning the status quo. That's always been there. That's kind of the root notion, actually. So the idea of there being objectivity in journalism is something that actually had to be constructed. That's not the natural position of journalism. Journalism is meant to be partisan. Okay? How do you know that? Well, I think in Europe it's really obvious how you see this. And this is true even in the United Kingdom, even today. Most of the major newspapers have clear ideological slants. Right? That is part of the legacy of journalism. That's where you still see this historic legacy of journalism there. And they're unapologetic about it, right? And what they're sort of doing is they're giving you a kind of view of the entire world from this perspective. Right? And that's why it's so easy, especially even in the UK, right? It's very easy to figure out who's the ideal reader of a given newspaper by the kinds of slants that are given on various things. So while all these newspapers might cover largely the same topics, and one of the things that's interesting, I would say, about journalism today is that, in fact, most, because it's so expensive to actually have reporters everywhere, right, most of the news that's actually produced is news that's coming from news agencies, you know, like Reuters or the Associated Press, those kinds of global international news agencies, which all the newspapers feed into, and then they spin them, right? And the spin is what you're buying when you buy the newspaper. Because if you just want to know what the news agencies are saying, the raw news, as it were, you could probably find that online with no problem. And that's, in fact, increasingly what people do. Okay? So the point here is that journalism, from the very beginning, was always, in some sense, biased and typically critical of the status quo. Right? So journalists, I mean, in the history of journalism, newspapers increased their circulation by being outrageous. Right? Sensationalism. And sensationalism usually means telling you something you didn't already know and perhaps people don't want you to know about. Right? So this is all very much part of the natural history of journalism, you might say, from the late 18th century. So the question then becomes, where does this objectivity in journalism come from? So the question is, why? Why do we even bother? Okay? And this becomes very important because, Morteza introduced in the beginning that I mentioned this guy. I don't know how many of you would be familiar with, but this is the man who is probably the most influential figure in the 20th century with regard to the self-understanding of journalism that we have today, where there's a kind of value placed on objectivity in journalism. I'm not saying that journalists are always objective, though that's certainly not true. I'm not saying newspapers are objective, but there's a sense in which journalists are meant to feel guilty if they're not objective. Right? So in other words, objectivity is supposed to be something you should try to go for, even if you can't achieve it, right? And so the person who kind of puts that kind of standard on the table as being what the point of journalism is this guy, Walter Lippmann, okay? And so Walter Lippmann was born in 1895. He died in the 1970s. This was a guy who coined a phrase that was very important. I mean, he was very important especially in the United States, self-understanding as a global power. And he talked about the American century. You may have heard Obama talk this way. Presidents often talk this way. The American century. And the context in which media objectivity gets developed has a lot to do with what's seen, you know, from Lippmann's standpoint, at the end of World War I to be America's place as it were, the eyes and ears of the world, right? That there's a sense in which if the world has a personality, as it were, if it has a kind of coherence, right, the eyes or ears are going to be increasingly from America, and so it becomes, because America is the ascendant global power. Because after World War I, all the countries of Europe, you know, even the winners were financially decimated, not just the losers, but the winners as well. Right? And America really kind of comes up to the plate and becomes this kind of global power that we're familiar with for the last 100 years or so. It's after World War I this happens. And of course, why does this happen? Well, because America, through the efforts of people like Walter Lippmann, actually decide to fight in a war that is not being fought on its land. World War I was not fought in America, it was fought in Europe, but the Americans come in toward the end and they settle the deal. And that that kind of indicates them. Lippmann is part of that. Lippmann is part of that as somebody in his 20s. Lippmann lives to the 1970s. He is an advisor to every president of the United States, from Woodrow Wilson, who got America into World War I, to Richard Nixon. Okay, that's a lot of presidents and a lot of different ideologies covering left to right. Okay? So Walter Lippmann's the man. And it's interesting because the way in which he kind of got into this way of thinking about things was not only a reflection on what he thought America was going to turn out to be. So he had a kind of vision of America as kind of the eyes and ears of the world, this kind of thing. But also he had this kind of view about what were the inadequacies of journalism that was as it was being practiced at the time. Because the first thing to say about the state of journalism in the early 20th century, in the period leading up to World War I, is that it's incredibly popular. I mean, you have circulation figures for newspapers already in the millions in the early 20th century. In fact, nowadays, most newspapers would love to have the circulation figures that they had 100 years ago. Okay? And what was going on in these newspapers? What was selling these newspapers? Well, people were incredibly, you'd have reporters, so the newspapers were typically run by these very wealthy guys. I mean, you've heard of Rupert Murdoch, right? Okay, well, he's kind of the last gasp of this old tradition that actually was very much in play in the early 20th century. So you've got guys like William Randolph Hearst. I don't know if you may not have heard of him, but he was a very important newspaper. If any of you have ever seen the film Citizen Kane from the 1930s, it's based on the life of this guy who was the first major media mogul in the United States. Okay? Another guy who was very much part of this scene was guy Joseph Pulitzer, after whom the Pulitzer Prize is named. He was a rival of Hearst. These were the media mogul guys. And these guys had lots of money, they were splashing out, they were buying in reporters. And these reporters were people who were revealing all kinds of things happening in the world and taking advantage of the new technology, whether we're talking about the telegraph, right, or later even radio, you know, very quick ways of transmitting information that became available in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Okay? And so that, you know, you'd see the, you know, even though these newspapers, I should say, in the early 20th century were still in the broadsheet design, right, they weren't yet tabloid is after World War I, but they were still broadsheet, but they had big pictures. Okay? And big head lurid headlines. Okay? Now the thing was that the people who these guys hired, and these guys were normally seen as kind of progressive guys. These were guys who were seen as empowering and enlightening the American people by telling them what was going on in the world and why they should get excited about it. So these were guys who were always trying to get America into wars. Right? America always has to step up to the plate. Okay, I mean, we still see this today. We know what we're talking. This comes from this period, okay? And so there was a whole group of these kind of people called muckrakers, a term you may have heard of, and is often discussed in a very positive kind of way. And it is positive. I'm not going to say it's not positive. But they're basically, they're kind of the origins of what we now call investigative journalism, right? Where people go behind the scenes, they show you the things people don't want to find out about. You know, and so they talk to the people firsthand. They have all kinds of very kind of strange ways of getting information nobody else can get access to. And they can take pictures, and the pictures can be put there. And so you can see all the horrible things happening in the world, you know, and you expose people, right? You're exposing things all the time, right? Muckrakers. This was selling newspapers. And it was also leading to a generally kind of progressive crusading spirit in the United States. That we are getting at the truth, we are going to get rid of all this bullshit that's blocking us, and we're going to find out what's happening, and then we'll be on top of things, and we'll be able to govern as a proper democratic country. That was the vision all these people were promoting. And if you know anything, the person who coined the term muckraker was the great President Theodore Roosevelt. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of this guy. This guy, speak softly, but carry a big stick. That was his motto. And he was a great sort of first global player on the American stage in the early 20th century. Beautiful stuff, right? Big problem, okay? The big problem was there wasn't any by what we would call quality control with regard to what these people were saying. Because the muckrakers were typically, one of the ways in which they were able to sell the newspapers, and I think you can recognize this from the kind of tabloid culture that still exists today, as well as from stuff like Fox News, is it appeals very emotionally, right? The people covering this stuff identified with what they were talking about to a very large extent, right? There was an enormous subjective element tossed into the news at a very detailed level. You know, I've been to the meatpacking plants and I see the awful conditions these people are working under and we need to change this, right? It was kind of in that vein. Well, one of the places where these guys, these muckrakers, went to in during the period of World War I was Russia, which was having a revolution at the same time World War I was going on, okay? And the muckrakers were, as I was pointing out, very liberal, progressive, democratic people, and they were very much on the side of the Bolsheviks, okay? And they were reporting all of these major victories, triumphs, you know, wonderful things that are going on. And even in the 1920s, you still had some of these, you know, the most famous muckraker, Lincoln Steffens, is famous for saying, "I have seen the future and it works." And he's talking about Russia, okay, in the 1920s. Now, the thing about these guys, though, and this is the thing that Littman points out as a young man, is that very often these people are not, you know, they are, in many cases, they are where the action is happening, but in terms of how they're interpreting what they're seeing, they're very much inhabiting the framework of the Bolsheviks. In other words, it's almost like they're enacting the press releases. Okay, so in other words, the journalist identifies so much with the subject matter that there is no kind of detachment. Okay? And so they get into the situation, but they see it entirely from the standpoint of the people who are interested in having them be there. Okay? And in this case, it happens to be, you know, the Lenin's people, in the case of the Soviet Union. And so what Littman points out is, early on, is that you end up getting a kind of distortion of what actually is happening on the ground. Right? And this then effectively turns out to be propaganda. You know, not intentionally, but because there is no sense of a professional standard for journalism. I mean, I think that's a very important point that Littman is raising very early on here. That until we get to this point, you know, so let's say 1920, okay, who are the sort of people who are journalists? Well, they are generally educated, well-educated people, but they're not. But there's no field called journalism, right? I mean, they're generally educated people, and very often, I mean, this is true of Lincoln Steffens, but a lot of these people, right, would at least partially fund their own activities. In other words, they were generally wealthy, do-gooder type people. Okay? And so Littman's point was, I mean, there was a veiled kind of criticism there of that kind of person. A person who could be easily sucked in, as it were, through wishful thinking about what's happening. And then because they have access to so many millions of people through the newspapers, that they end up in, you know, kind of unwittingly promote this propaganda. And so what this means, according to Littman, is that you need to have a specific professional standard for journalism that is independent, right, of your interests, of the subject matter, of anything else. And also independent of the employer. Because, of course, the employer is interested in selling papers, and so they're more than happy to promote this idea that all this very exciting stuff, positive stuff, is going on. Right? So the media moguls are not stopping this. So the journalists themselves are going to have to somehow come up with certain standards of ethics and conduct and so forth. Okay? And you know, so Littman believes this is really important in the American context because of the ascendant role that the United States is going to have in this period after World War I. And so, in a sense, the U.S. has got to show the way. It's got to smarten up its act in terms of how it reports the news. And also because there's so much wealth that is produced by the media already in the 1920s in the United States, okay, that potentially, right, the news agencies and the newspapers that are coming out of the country are going to be setting the standard for the whole world. Okay, so this is about 100 years ago this is being argued. And this is what opens the kind of door to thinking about what media objectivity means. Okay? Now, Lippmann had a particular take on this matter, because when and that's where it is different from scientific objectivity. Okay, to give you a sense of what scientific objectivity is, I'll come back to it later, but just to get you kind of in the right frame of mind about this, one of the things that scientists often say, you know, in terms of the way they operate, is they follow the truth wherever it may lead, right? And of course, historically, one of the places where truth often leads is to the overturning of conventional assumptions, the overturning of traditions, the overturning of authority, right? This is very much part of, you know, you think about Galileo against the church and Darwin, you know, you think about the great scientists, a large number of them have got themselves into trouble at various points in their careers, right? And in any case, science, I think it's fair to say, presents at the end of this process a rather radically different world from the world you thought you lived in, right? I mean, that is one of the things about science. In fact, it's one of the things that you might say makes science kind of intriguing and entertaining to people, is the fact that what science typically tells you about the world is not what you thought at all. It's this other thing going on. Now, Lippmann did not believe this was the kind of frame of mind that journalists should lead the public in. Okay, so this is where media objectivity starts to become different from scientific objectivity. Because one of the points here, and again, I think here's where you have to take kind of seriously Lippmann's view about the importance of journalism in the United States. Namely, if this is going to be the global leader, then it's going to be important that one of the functions of journalism is to keep the people kind of neutralized, right? In other words, you know, this is because the world is a very crazy place. Nobody denies this. Certainly was the crazy place when Lippmann was around, and everybody knows that. The question is, to what extent does the media have to represent and amplify the craziness? In whose interest is this? Does it serve the public interest? Right? Does it serve the political interest, the interest of the political class trying to do something about it? Lippmann's answer is no. Right? That there's a sense in which what media objectivity needs to be is, in a sense, a presentation of what actually is going on in the world. So if there's a war going on, don't hide it. But you present the war in a way that it looks like the people, you know, who are running the war have got it under control. Right? What you do not do is you start reporting things that would tend to undermine the national interest. Okay? And why is that? I mean, see, the way Lippmann saw this matter, and you know, you need to think about this issue here, is Lippmann thought that the primary reason why in the past journalism has veered toward this kind of demystifying investigative approach is because it could sell papers, right? People want to be shocked. People want to be outraged. But the newspapers themselves are not in any great position to do anything positive as a result. It is not like a newspaper is going to replace the government. But what the newspaper can do is to destabilize the government. Okay, so from the standpoint of the public interest, right, Lippmann believed that one had to be very careful, right, and in this respect, be very mindful of the kind of power that journalism wields simply by virtue of having access to so many people's, you know, minds by people reading it. Okay, so that one needs to be very careful about how one balances this responsibility. So, for example, you know, if Lippmann were alive today, you know, WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden, all those guys, they would be on the shit list, right? That's for sure. Because there's a sense in which, what have those guys done? Those guys have done exactly the kind of thing that Lippmann was against. Namely, okay, they put all this stuff out there, right? They encourage newspapers to publish the most lurid aspects of it. And then what? And then what? Well, there's a lot of confusion, a lot of, you know, finger-pointing, a lot of blaming, a lot of trying to chase people down, you know, and a lot of maybe demystification about political process, and people say they don't believe they're politicians anymore. And then where are we on the other side of that? We just have cynicism. We have nothing constructive. This is his view, right? And the thing is, of course, that Littman, when Littman is writing this originally in the 1920s, he's already seeing what's happening in the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution, which was originally portrayed so positively. He's beginning to see that a culture of authoritarianism is beginning to set in, right? And it's not just about liberating people and democracy and stuff like that. And so the problem comes from the fact that people were set up to believe this was a glorious moment, right? That you know, but in fact, it turns out to be a complete disappointment. So then what do you conclude if you have this kind of bipolar swing in political sensibilities? You basically distrust politics, right? And you distrust politicians. And for Littman, that is the most fatal thing that can happen in democracy, because that then opens the door to really nasty things to happen. Okay, so what Littman's point here was about media objectivity was it was to present what is actually going on in the world, but in a way that, as it were, persuades people that it's under control, right? That it may be bad, but our people have it under control. So this is the reason why, of course, Littman and a lot of people who have argued this, you know, this kind of line on media objectivity have in fact been advisors to major political players, right? Because they can be trusted, right? So, you know, a president or a prime minister can tell somebody like Walter Littman, you know, by God, we got all these issues going on in the war and people are getting killed and all the rest of it. And then he gets some advice from Littman, but Littman's not going to go out there and, you know, write an expose saying, my God, stuff's awful. Okay? And so this is a kind of a, you know, so what is the nature of media objectivity in this context? Well, it certainly has something to do with taking responsibility for what you're representing. Right? So in other words, if you're publishing certain things in a newspaper, right, you're thinking ahead as to what the consequences are going to be once people read this stuff. And the question is whether you can live with the consequences of that. I mean, I don't know if you ever look at the New York Times, okay, which has kind of been now almost for a century the main kind of newspaper of record in the United States. The motto of the New York Times is all the news that's fit to print. That's the motto of the New York Times. You ever pick up a copy of the New York Times, you'll see that right on top. All the news that's fit to print. Okay? This is Littman. Right? All the news. And one of the things that you see that's very characteristic of the New York Times style of reporting, okay, is the fact that it is done in it is almost in a studiously neutral fashion, to the point of boring. Okay? You know, in other words, there isn't an attempt to kind of rally people up I think this is an interesting exercise. New York Times is normally seen to be a left of center paper in the United States. It's the newspaper of record, more or less, but it's also a left of center paper. Same is true also of the Washington Post, which would be the other newspaper one would think about. Left of center newspaper. But you compare the style of writing in those papers with, let's say, the style of writing in The Guardian. Even The Guardian, okay? And The Guardian, everybody recognizes to be a, you know, well-written, sophisticated, broadsheet newspaper, right? Doesn't talk down to its readers, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it's really clear what the difference is between these two papers that are supposedly ideologically similar, okay? From the standpoint of a normal Guardian reader, the New York Times and the Washington Post are bland. They're bland. Now, that blandness is kind of part of what Littman wants, okay? That people just kind of take the news, and this, by the way, had a lot of impact, not just in the newspaper world. It really influenced also the way in which the news is presented in radio and television. Think about it, right? When you have the anchor people on the news programs, they're virtually replaceable, right? I mean, you have to be a very sophisticated watcher of news programs to kind of see the differences in the style between newsreaders, because in fact, they are supposed to be very neutral in the manner. So the possibility of laughing, smiling, getting angry, when these things actually do happen on air, they're big deals. Right? Whereas, you know, a normal person with a lot of the news that's actually being reported, if a normal person were reading it, they'd go nuts. Right? You think about the average anchor person, if they were really thinking about what they were reporting in the news every night, all the various stories, each one only lasting for a minute or two, and they're going through 15 of these stories in a half hour. You know, 3,000 people dead here, you know, this person wins a music prize. You know, I mean, you know, you get these things one after another. You know, this would be emotionally very jarring for a normal person to have to go through all this stuff. But the newsreader, they're neutral, right? Or they maybe smile a little or something, or look a little serious. But they don't really move beyond a certain kind of neutral level. That is deliberate, obviously, right? That is deliberate. And that doesn't have to do, that's not because it necessarily makes the news more comprehensible. It's because that is what the look of objectivity is. That's what objectivity looks like from the visual and oral standpoint. Okay? So all of that actually needed, and you know, and one of the ways you could see this kind of in action is when you look at the, if you look at the news channels that don't actually have these kinds of norms operating. So again, think about Fox News. When Fox News, I hope most of you have seen Fox News at some point in your life. This American-based cable television channel that's all over the world. Okay, the thing that's really interesting about Fox News, right, is because Fox News is quite clear it doesn't obey, they're post-Lippman-esque, you might say. Post-Lippman, if you can imagine that, right? Post-Lippman. In the sense that the kind of people that they actually recruited to do a lot of their news reading, okay, are sportscasters and DJs when Fox News started, right? So in other words, the kind of energy and emotionality that you would normally associate with those specific forms of broadcasting were brought into the center of news. And if you look at the way these people present on Fox, and it's actually kind of caught on to a lot of the other cable channels as well. I mean, even CNN picks up on this, right? Right, that is coming from that world, that kind of emotionality, right, that kind of energy. But this is the kind of thing exactly that Lippman was trying to neutralize, because he thought that this would just add instability to an already unstable world. And you see, this is the kind of interesting sort of arrangement that he was going after, because in the first instance, Lippman is going to grant people have a right to know what's going on in the world. So in that initial sense, he's a Democrat, right? He doesn't want to close down the newspapers. He wants people to read what's happening. He wants people to hear about what's happening. People should be informed. There's no doubt about it. He believed people should vote in elections and all the rest of it. But what he didn't believe was that people should get riled up in such a way to get excited and emotional about things that they are in no position to do anything about, and for which they have, in fact, elected people to do the stuff for them. Okay, and that in this respect, this is where he believed that a lot of the newspapers in the earlier eras were in fact mischievous, because in order to raise circulation, they were drumming up emotion. With what would be the end of that? What would be the consequence of that? Who knows? I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, for those of you who are interested in political revolution, you know, maybe some of you are. A lot of people who get involved in media get interested in this. There are a couple of periods you should be looking at, where in a sense you had a kind of, you might say, media-driven revolution that didn't go anywhere, that basically collapsed on itself. And in fact, in many cases, led to a kind of stronger version of the status quo. And the great one is 1848, okay? So 1848, which is, say, about 50 years after the French Revolution, there's a whole series of what we would call now nationalistic revolutions across Europe. And part of what was fueling that was the fact that a lot of the national languages, in the sense of the provincial languages of the different parts of Europe, because Europe is still governed under empires to a large extent, but the sort of different regions of Europe, their languages were developing their own newspapers, their own literatures, all this kind of thing was going on, and this was becoming the basis of kind of political uprising. And so 1848 saw a whole slew of these kind of liberal revolutions, as they were called, because these were revolutions that were fueled by the power of the press, the power of free expression that a lot of the monarchies of Europe were allowing because the newspapers, because they're such big money makers, pay taxes, right? How did free expression spread in Europe? It sold copies, and then the government would tax it, and the government would be able to survive on it. That's why all this free expression came about in the first place, okay? It made money, people bought it. And so this is the issue about how you sell the papers is not a trivial point. So the point is, in 1848, you get all these revolutions across Europe. They all fail. And in fact, Marx's Communist Manifesto, have you heard of that work? The Communist Manifesto? Okay, that is written as a response to that massive failure. And that's where Marx says, you know, the bourgeoisie, these middle class people, these liberals, these free expression types, these guys, you know, they're all talk and no walk, right? They make a lot of noise, but then when they actually overturn the government, they don't know what to do. They can't agree on anything and everything goes back to normal again. And that's why you can never trust those liberals. Same thing happens in 1905. In Russia, in Turkey, in Mexico, in all kinds of places, the same thing happens. You may have heard of the Decembrist Revolution in Russia that failed. This is what we're talking about. Same thing again, and in this time in more parts of the world, emerging middle class, free expression, liberals making up, talking up a storm, saying we need to take control of the government, look at all these horrible things people are doing, nothing happens. We go back to repression. And it's all, and the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 is the first one to really work. To actually change things. And it's violent. It's very violent. Okay? So the thing here is that Lippmann knows this. Okay? Lippmann knows this stuff. He knows the history. He knows that the whole idea of having just a kind of free expression and people just expressing themselves publicly on all kinds of issues doesn't go anywhere if there is no follow-through, and that journalists are typically in no position to organize new governments and new ways of organizing people. Now, you know about the Arab Spring from 5 years ago and all these other so-called social media revolutions that have taken place. What's happened? Failure. It, again, another bourgeois failure. Right? And this is where Lippmann says, look, if you don't want to go to a position that's actually worse than the one you have now, then you need a kind of disciplined media and a relationship between the media and the people in power so that there actually can be some kind of gradual sense of progressive change. Okay, so that is the context in which media objectivity came into being through Walter Lippmann, okay? And we still see it, it's the kind of thing that if you go to journalism school, people talk to you about and teach you and say this is kind of the mark of the professional journalist, and it gets manifested in a lot of very detailed methodological ways, like checking your sources and things like this. And Lippmann, famous piece he did in 1920 on the test of the news about the Russian Revolution, there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there. And so we still live, you might say, with the downstream effects of this kind of sense of media objectivity, where one wants to be very measured and cautious in the way in which one presents what's happening in the world. Okay, but clearly we're living in a world now where this is very difficult to maintain. And the main reason why it's difficult to maintain is actually the main reason why it's difficult to maintain scientific objectivity too. So even though media objectivity and scientific objectivity are somewhat different from each other, they're both threatened by the same thing, and that's, in a word, the internet. Okay? In other words, the possibility of there being so many different channels, so many different means by which information can be communicated, both produced and distributed, that the whole idea of broadcasting goes out the window, okay? Because look, broadcasting is the metaphor of broadcasting. If you see the radio tower, right? And the radio tower has all of these lightning bolts going through it, right? So from one location, we can contact the world, right? That's the image of broadcasting. One source, multiple receivers. okay? But of course, we live in a world where that's not the case, because you've got multiple broadcasters, and in that case, it's not, you know, you don't have that kind of pyramid arrangement anymore, right? It's rather everybody's communicating with everyone, potentially. And so this then, what it does is it makes it very difficult actually to control the flow of information. So in other words, see, the kind of world that Lippmann was imagining, right, was in the early days of broadcasting, right, where Lippmann is imagining there are still relatively few people controlling most of the newspapers. We've got radio, which is also a relatively controlled medium in terms of licensing. And of course, downstream you get television, which until the 1970s was relatively controlled, until we got cable television, okay? So during this period that Lippmann is living, right, there is a sense in which media can still be understood as a very kind of concentrated power base for knowledge production, right? And a lot of the critiques of the media from Adorno and Frankfurt School, if you're familiar with any of that stuff, presupposes this kind of model, right, where there are relatively few. And so the issue here is that if the elites can manage themselves, then the rest of the public will follow. And so Lippmann basically is giving a strategy for how the elites manage themselves. But now we live in a world where, in a sense, the elites are being broken apart by the way in which the knowledge is being produced and distributed. And here the internet plays a very important role, where it's very difficult to know what counts as authoritative. Right? So you may get a lot of people, you know, pretending to be objective, but they're all saying different things. You're forced to decide. And this is actually happening in the scientific arena as well. Okay? And it's one of the things that leads to increasing amount of controversy and a difficulty in terms of resolving things, you know, at any kind of politically consensual level. Right? Where in a sense, you know, arguments just continue on and on and on without closure. And so, in a sense, this kind of notion of objectivity can be exploded simply by virtue of a change in the way in which the knowledge is being produced nowadays in the media. And so there's a question, you know, the question on the table, I suppose, for us is whether there's anything still of value of this idea of media objectivity that Lippmann was aspiring to, and which I think the journalistic profession still pays a certain amount of lip service to, whether there's still something worth preserving there, or whether we are indeed developing into a world that is much more like an informational free-for-all, right? Where in a sense, you know, everybody's forced to kind of make their own decisions as to what to believe, what to get, you know, what to buy, what to do, and that there it becomes impossible then to collectivize that in any kind of way to create a state of stability in the society. Okay, and so I will stop there and open it up to questions. So you can clap if you want.
Is there any questions?
Yeah, please. We got time for it. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to ask you about the Levinson inquiry.
Oh yeah.
And what's your views about the press having some kind of code?
Yes. Well, this is the thing. You see, this is a good, you know, the Levinson inquiry, right? Because of all these newspapers that were doing wiretaps and things on people's phones and all the rest of it, and it was happening on a mass scale, and it was quite clearly motivated by selling newspapers. Exactly the point, right? You're exactly on the point. It's kind of up-to-date version of this. And Levinson's general view, right, was kind of like, you know, if the press can't do it itself, so to say, you know, then the government needs to step in, right? And I think this idea, and of course the response of the press was to say, well, we can do it in some form, right? Now that's still paying lip, you know, insofar as we trust the press to do that, we're still believing in the Lippmann dream, right? Because that would be the Lippmann answer, right? The press can manage itself, right? And in fact, the press wouldn't be seen as professional if it didn't manage itself. But of course, in the world we live in now, it's a very much an open question. And that's why, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the long-term effects of that is, but it seems to me at the moment, it's kind of just sat there. It's just kind of there, right? In other words, the press is still being allowed pretty much to manage itself. So I think in that respect, there is still a kind of lip service to the Lippmann idea, even though the practice of the press, you know, shows it's still very much like it was 100 years ago.
Can
can we say that, I mean, this idea, the rhetoric of neutrality after this would be a kind of weapon at the hand of some of the media, for example, BBC principle of impartiality is a kind of, you know, a tool that they can use to say that we are different from Russia Today, RT, or Al Jazeera, etc. So, I mean...
Yeah, but that idea comes from way before any of those guys were around. I mean, that idea is actually, the thing about the BBC, right, gets started in 1927, so it's well before any of this stuff happens, and they're already saying the point is that, you know, the media needs to, right, to inform, educate, and entertain, right, the three principles of the BBC, and they've been very much... This kind of idea is actually, I would say, very Lippmann-esque, because the intention of having these three things as being the principles is actually, in a kind of slow, gradual way, training up the population, right? You know, in other words, you know, so the idea here being that you know, and I think it's true, if you compare the BBC with what's available on commercial channels in this country, right, the kind of framing of what the average audience member is a much more ennobling one, I think, on the part of the BBC. The BBC is less patronizing, less catering to people's tastes. And that's one of the reasons why, by the way, the license fee has been very important, because it serves as kind of a buffer. Because if you're just living by ratings, right, then there's going to be a tendency for programming to gravitate to the lowest common denominator. But if you've got some kind of public government subsidy, then you don't have to always be, you know, earning your keep on the back of your own programming, right? You get this extra money. So it's one of the arguments, actually, for keeping the government subsidy for the BBC, is that what it does is... The broadcaster is basically training up the population on a regular basis. And I think that's a very Lippmann-esque approach to how you deal with a democracy. In other words, you don't just give people, you know, naked, lurid details, you know, and then let them flounder with it, but rather you kind of shape them. And I think the BBC, the BBC's always been about that. I mean, there's a very famous, the guy who started the BBC, first director general, was John Reith. And so these three principles, inform, educate, entertain, are the Reithian principles. There was a very famous interview that was done with John Reith in the late 50s, early 60s, after the BBC had already been around for over 30 years. It's interesting to hear what this man actually says about why the BBC is constructed this way, because it is very clear that he sees the BBC as... really an educator, a director of the population, an improver of the population, that's for sure. Yeah, and then, you know, and things like the way that these people speak on air. I mean, I was first a student here in the late 1970s, and my God, I mean, things have really changed in terms of the accents that are tolerated these days on the BBC, but when I was here in the 1970s, it was all the King, Queen's English, that was about it. Yeah. Other questions? That was a good question. Come on, guys.
I have a question or a comment. One of the students will jump in. I'm quite interested in how, if we take Facebook, one of the biggest sort of media platforms in the world in terms of active members, employs very few, anybody who would come close to equating to a journalist. And Facebook doesn't have to spend much on people to write copy and write the things that we read. So. Is a kind of prosumer engagement. We produce our own content,
we consume,
we write messages for friends, we photograph our lunch, or
whatever
it is, that we're boring content that we put on Facebook, we all love it. Are we moving away from the defining characteristic being objectivity towards authenticity, I guess? You mentioned the emotions, but to be real and to perform your kind of a real self online has more value.
Except you can multiply your identities indefinitely, right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, that kind
it's
of is a two. Yeah, I mean, but I do think the first point is certainly true, namely that the model, you might say, the model of the world that allows you to have objectivity, where there's the subject and there's the object, and we want to understand what the thing really is, and it's different from us. Mm. That's disappearing, right? Because in a sense, right, you know, Lippmann is operating on the assumption that look, there's stuff happening out there in the world. And some people know about it and some people don't. And the question is, how do you get the people who know about it to tell the people who don't know about it? But I think the kind of world you're talking about, this prosuming world, is one where these two roles are mixed in a kind of ineradicable way almost. So the reality is something that's being manufactured by the people observing it. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a kind of participatory, a reality, much more than what this model would presuppose. Other questions?
Any other questions?
No? Are you sure? Yes.
Do you think, obviously, with the increase of social media and people being able to spread knowledge and information like as a platform from the South, is going to be a less of a need of investigative journalism and journalism in general?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I think this is going to be... This is one area where I think journalism may want to reassert itself in a sense, right? Because, you know, like something like the BBC, for example, right? If you go to the BBC website, whenever there's a breaking story, the BBC always says, you know, are you there? Do you have pictures of what's going on, right? And you can start sending your stuff into them. But the interesting thing, of course, is what do they do with it? How do they vet that? How do they decide what to put on and what not to put on, right? That's still the role of the journalist there, right? So there's already a kind of a, you might say, a sort of a relationship developing between the way social media can contribute to more conventional journalism. And I think that's an interesting thing to study, actually, to be perfectly honest with you, about how the norms of professional journalism could be reinvented in that context, right? Where the journalist does draw the line between what the social media is producing and what of that could be taken to be proper journalism. So that may be where the line gets drawn in the future.
We're almost out of time.
Okay. But
thank you very much, Sofia, for everything.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And I should say that in a couple of weeks we will have another lecture here, another seminar, since we've been speaking seminars about social media.